May it please the court, I'm Andrew Cooper, 23036, for the people. Colorado should recognize that at step two of a Batson analysis, a juror's statements reflecting racial bias constitute a facially race-neutral reason for a party's exercise of a peremptory strike. As happens in many trials, during the jury selection process in this case, one juror, juror number five, expressed personal preconceived bias, but also assured the court that she would listen to the evidence, decide the case based on the law, and be fair. Because she gave that assurance that she would be fair, and because the court accepted that assurance, the court properly denied the prosecution's challenge for cause. Because by statute and rule, if the court is satisfied that the juror will be fair, the court should deny the challenge for cause. But that does not preclude a party, like the prosecutor here, from exercising a peremptory challenge based on the prosecutor's own view and own concern that the statements by the juror suggest that there could be a problem with fairness. There's a three-step process under the Batson case, which imposes a limitation on the exercise of peremptory challenges. What Batson prohibits is the exercise of a peremptory challenge based on the juror's race. It turns on the motivation of the attorney who is the proponent of the peremptory strike. At step one, if the party who is lodging the Batson challenge and opposing the peremptory strike establishes a prima facie case of racial discrimination, which is a relatively low level of proof. They merely need to show an inference of racial discrimination. Then the burden of production shifts to the proponent of the strike, in this case the prosecutor, to articulate a facially race-neutral reason for making that peremptory strike. At step two, the persuasiveness and even the believability of the race-neutral reason is not at issue, as long as the statement on its face is race-neutral, then the proponent of the strike has satisfied step two. The court is then supposed to go to step three and make an assessment of whether the race-neutral reason stated at step two is the true motivation of the proponent of the strike. And if at step three, the court assessing things like the demeanor of the proponent of the strike and other factors, if at step three, the court in effect says, proponent of the strike, I don't believe you. You've said that you're striking this juror for some facially race-neutral reason, but I think you are lying to the court. I think that actually you are striking this juror because of the juror's race. Then the court sustains the Batson challenge and precludes a party from exercising the strike.
Now, counsel, explain to me how. Okay, so the court effectively accepted that the juror had been rehabilitated and that this juror was in fact capable of being fair and open-minded, even though, you know, she had concerns about the unequal treatment of African Americans in our justice system, a concern that may very well be founded in fact. How was the court then supposed to close its eyes and pretend like the rehabilitation had not taken place in allowing the peremptory strike to stand?
Because just because the judge has reached the conclusion that the judge believes that the juror will be able to set aside those preconceived notions does not mean that the prosecutor cannot honestly have concerns that the individual is not going to be able to set aside those preconceived notions and instead make the decision based on the evidence and the law. The judge in this case could only sustain the Batson challenge and preclude the prosecutor from exercising the strike if the judge concluded that the prosecutor did not have that honest belief, that the prosecutor was lying to the court in indicating that the prosecutor had concerns about the individual's ability to set aside those preconceived notions. The judge could only sustain the Batson challenge if the judge thought that the prosecutor, instead of having concerns about this individual's preconceived notions, was striking the juror because of the juror's race.
Counsel, you outlined the three Batson steps very effectively and very clearly. However, in the trial court, the steps were not so clearly outlined by the parties or the court. The court did not say, I'm looking at step number one and whether or not the prosecutor, or whether or not the defendant, rather, has shown a prima facie case of racial discrimination. And now I'm looking at step number two, trying to determine whether or not the prosecution's explanation is facially race neutral. And now I'm going to look at step three. It didn't go through that. And so it seems to me that it is difficult from the record that we have to determine how and what the court was doing. How do we, and it's your argument, I believe, that the court found the prosecutor's racially neutral explanation not to be racially neutral. How do we know that what the court was finding was not the credibility determination under step three instead?
First of all, the district court's failure to articulate those steps is part of the problems with its ruling. That is part of its error. And under the U.S. Supreme Court case of Perkins versus Elam, that by itself was erroneous. It should not be conflating those steps. But to answer the court's question, I think that we only need to look at what the court did and said. First of all, to the extent that the court was applying the three-step process, we can infer that it concluded that the defendant had satisfied step one, because when the defendant raised Batson, the court, as to juror number one, not juror number five, but as to juror number one, the court denied the Batson challenge out of hand without asking for the prosecutor to articulate a race-neutral reason, indicating that as to juror number one, the court did not believe that the defendant had even established a prima facie inference of discrimination. But then as to juror number five, the court turned to the prosecutor for an explanation, indicating that apparently as to juror number five, the court believed that the defendant had satisfied step one and indicated or had established a prima facie case. But regarding steps two and three, I think that we only need to look at what the court actually said. After the prosecutor articulated her reason, and she listed a number of reasons based on this juror's own statements about her personal bias, the court, or the defendant, the defense attorney, then said, all the reasons asserted by Ms. McCallum are race reasons as to why she is excusing this juror. They are not race neutral. These are specifically talking about race. And then on page 224 of the April 26th transcript, the court said, yeah, there is no reason, neutral reason here. And then she went on to explain about how her perception was that the juror had assured her that she could be fair. And then the court, at lines 15 and 16 of page 224 of the transcript, said, you have not stated a race-neutral reason that I can support. And then, again on page 225 of the transcript, lines 11 and 12, I still do not find you are striking her for a race-neutral reason. So the language of her statements is a step two language. She's talking in terms of whether it is a race-neutral reason. At no point does she say, although I accept that that is a race-neutral reason, based on your demeanor, I am concluding that I do not believe that that is your true motivation. The judge never says anything of that sort at all.
Mr. Cooper, to the extent that the court conflated step two and step three, or it's at least not clear from the record that they were making some sort of differentiation or which step the court was actually deciding on, is there some obligation on the part of the prosecutor as the party who's bringing the appeal to have asked the court for some sort of clarification?
Excuse me. Well, the prosecutor did ask for more specific findings the following morning for purposes of the appeal, and that's on the April 27th transcript, and we've alluded to that in our briefs, and the court simply refused to make any further record regarding her findings.
Let me follow up on that. I'm sorry. Did you have more?
No.
Let me follow up on that. If the court did not clarify her findings the following morning, if we cannot determine exactly where the court was based upon the language of the court that you just mentioned, what are we supposed to do?
Then you should disapprove the court's ruling for a failure to make an adequate record as to the nature of its ruling. The court has an obligation to make factual findings, especially if the court truly had proceeded to stage three and was making a credibility determination. It needs to articulate some basis for that so that the appellate court can review it and determine whether it's appropriate.
Wouldn't it be the appellant's responsibility to carry the burden of proving to us that the court in fact erred, and not that it's just unclear?
The prosecutor did at step two was to articulate her facially race-neutral reason. That's her obligation at that step. The court, in our view, denied it at step two and said that's not a race-neutral reason. It is contradictory for the defendant to argue the argument that they've made, which is both that this was not race neutral and that there was a credibility assessment against the prosecutor. That does not make sense. If the court accepted that the prosecutor's statement at step two was race neutral, then to resolve that credibility determination against the prosecutor at step three, I'm flipping that around. If as the defense has argued, this is not a race-neutral reason, and the court made that finding, then the court at step three would be saying, prosecutor, at step two, you articulated that you are throwing the juror off the jury because of her race. But here at step three, I'm resolving credibility against you. I don't believe you. I don't believe that you're throwing her off because of her race. I believe that you actually threw her off for a legitimate reason and would deny the Batson challenge on that basis. That does not make sense.
You have about a minute left if you would like to reserve any time.
Yes, please.
Counsel.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Lynn Nesner, attorney registration 39209. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Larkins, appellee. In Batson, the United States Supreme Court made clear that the privilege to strike individual jurors through the use of peremptory challenges is subject to the commands of the Equal Protection Clause in the Constitution. The U.S. Supreme Court created the Batson test in part because The court recognized the practical difficulty in ferreting out discrimination in the jury selection process, which is discretionary by nature. The Batson framework requires trial courts to be sensitive to the discriminatory use of peremptory challenges and to consider all relevant circumstances, which is exactly what the trial court did here. Contrary to the state's argument, the court properly applied Batson. There was no misapplication of the law. After the defense met the first step of showing a prima facie inference of discrimination, the court turned to the prosecution for a race-neutral reason. The prosecution stated the juror was biased because she, quote, thinks too many African Americans are being prosecuted. The prosecution stated that when the prosecutor asked her if this was the right case for her, quote, she said it was not. The prosecutor also brought up the fact that her husband, the juror's husband, was arrested for defending himself against racial threats. The court allowed the defense to respond, and the defense argued that the prosecution's reasons failed because they were all related to the juror's race. The court then proceeded to the third step. At the third step, the court evaluated the persuasiveness of the prosecution's rationale and found it lacking. The court made a credibility finding about the prosecution's reason. The court found, you have not stated a race-neutral reason that I can support. The prosecution then reframed its rationale, saying she was not striking the juror because the juror was black, but because she was concerned about the juror's ability to be fair and impartial, which on its face is neutral. The court ruled, I still do not find that you are striking her for a race-neutral reason. The court at that point had rejected the prosecution's rationale and implicitly was finding purposeful discrimination. Thus, the court sustained the Batson objection and reset the juror.
Counsel, in your view, did the court make a step two finding?
I don't know that at the second step there needs to be, I mean, at the second step, the prosecution has to offer something that is neutral to meet the second step. And then whether or not it's believable or credible comes at the third step.
And so are you conceding that the excuse or the reason offered by the prosecutor in this case was in fact race neutral so as to satisfy step two?
I'm arguing the state's rationale is lacking in several regards. I would say that this idea that the juror, the vast majority of the prosecution's asserted justifications for their strike were tied to the juror's race.
But, excuse me, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but Judge Burris was asking, do you agree that a step two determination was made by the trial court? And do you agree that the prosecutors made a facially race-neutral explanation? And did the court accept that as a facially race-neutral explanation?
I think initially, I guess I'm saying I don't know that the court needs to make any findings at the second step. This is the third step that encompasses all the court's findings. So the fact that the prosecution cannot meet the second step can be something that the court considers at the third step for why that the court may want to, you know, sustain the Batson objection. But,
well, if the court agrees that it's not race neutral, then would they ever reach the third step? They say if the court could rule what you're assigning isn't race neutral because it's tied to the potential jurors' attitudes about race, whether that's right or wrong as a matter of law, does that necessarily mean that they would have reached the third step?
I'm saying when the court decides either to grant or deny the Batson challenge or motion, that the court is implicitly making a finding as the third step, and if the prosecution had not met the second step, then that is something the court could take into consideration, and potentially that could be the sum total of the findings that the court makes at the third step. You didn't meet the second step, so we don't need to, I don't need to make extensive findings at the third step, but it is the third step that is where all the findings occur and where the court makes the ultimate determination as to whether the party raising the Batson objection had met its burden.
Okay, let's look at the race neutrality for a second. Let's say that you have a Caucasian juror who is married to an African-American, and that person is strongly of the opinion that African-Americans don't get a very good chance or fair shake in the legal system. If that person, being a Caucasian, expressed those views, much as, let's say, they use the same words that this juror made, could they not be stricken? And it wouldn't be because of their race, it would be because of their attitudes about race. Is there a difference?
I think the state is drawing a very fine distinction, and then you can draw a fine distinction about opinions about race and race, but is it a meaningful difference if the juror's opinions are based on her life experiences as an African-American woman? And at what point does this sort of, I think the rule the state is asking for would create a very confusing, blurry line where the exception could then, I mean, swallow Batson, because if something that has a race tie or race base can suffice at the second step, then Batson doesn't really have teeth. And I think, you know, questions about, well, what if a juror of this color, you know, shared the same views, are not that valuable here, because really the state is asking you to review the court's ultimate determination of credibility at the third step, and the court rejected the state's rationale. I mean, the court did not believe that the juror would be unfair or biased. I mean, the juror had been rehabilitated, and at the third step, the court can make a credibility determination as to the juror and to the prosecution. So,
well, does a peremptory challenge have to be the same level as a challenge for cause? Let's say, for example, there's a juror that's just glaring at one counsel or the other, but they don't ever say anything that would provide a basis for challenge for cause. Can't that attorney assume that they, for some reason, the juror either doesn't like them or doesn't like the side they represent, or for some reason can't be unfair from the facial expressions? Is that not legitimate?
A demeanor, someone could be, they could use a peremptory strike, and if it was a person of color or gender related, or, you know, if Batson was applicable, but then it would be up to that specific trial court to make a credibility determination as to whether the person striking that juror was striking it at least in any part related to that person's race. And here we have the court in these specific circumstances making a finding that the court didn't believe the prosecutor. The prosecutor wasn't striking the juror for a race-neutral reason.
I'm just saying that the court justified its ruling by saying that the juror could be fair, which kind of related back to the challenge for cause. But the court never said, I don't think that the prosecutor's reason is legitimate, or I think that it's a pretext, you know, they're really striking them for racial reasons. The court just basically reiterated the ruling on the challenge for cause, and I'm not sure that that's
the court's
number step three.
You have not stated, I mean, a reason that I can support.
Well, a race-neutral reason that I can support, so maybe that's a step two finding.
But there are no findings at step two. All the findings happen at step three. The court's saying, you have not struck her for a reason that I think is separate or independent of race. The court was finding that race was part of the prosecutor's rationale for its strike. And it wasn't it, because the juror had said she should be fair. I mean, she repeatedly, at least four or five times on the record, she said she could be fair. She said that she would absolutely find the defendant guilty if the state met its burden. She said she would not reach a verdict just to send a message. She also said she had been a recent victim of theft, and that it was important for the person who did it to be prosecuted.
She said, it's important to me that justice truly be served. This was a juror who many of her responses were completely appropriate and who was not unsure about her ability to serve. And the prosecutor said one of her reasons was that when she had asked the juror if it was the right case for her, quote, which she said it was not. In fact, that is not what the record shows. When she asked the juror in chambers if this was the right case for her, the juror responded, I want to serve. I feel that I can be fair. I do not think that the record supports the state's assertion that the juror could not be fair. I think that the state's strike was at least based on an assumption or a fear that this juror would be partial to another African-American man, because the juror had acknowledged what is essentially objective fact, that minorities do not receive equal treatment.
Okay, I guess I'm saying, does it matter whether or not the court believed that the juror could be fair as opposed to the prosecutor, and is that even tied to race? For example, if there, like I said, had been a Caucasian juror that said, I feel like African-Americans don't get a good shake in the system, and that's not obviously a strike based on the juror's race, which would be Caucasian, but it would be a strike based on the attitudes. And I think somehow you're trying to combine the two.
I'm saying that could be the distinction in your case. And maybe the trial judge in that case would find that that was a race-neutral reason, and that the court, and allow the prosecution to, you know, or whatever side is moving to strike. Maybe the court, but...
I don't mean to argue with you, but didn't you say that they don't find that there's a race-neutral reason, that all the findings are made at step three? So I'm a little troubled by that part of the argument.
Yes, all the findings are made at step three. And because that is the step where the court makes the determination as to whether or not to grant or deny the Batson objection.
Okay, well, let's take a different hypothetical. Let's say that the court says, I believe that you're telling the court the true reason why you struck her, but I just don't think that it rises to the level of being race neutral. Now, is that a court's ruling on step two as opposed to step three?
Then what does the court ultimately do? Resit the juror? I mean, I think the court has made a ruling when the court resat the juror. I guess I'm having a, I'm trying to answer your questions as best I can, but I find that ultimately here, the court did not believe. Yes, there could be a situation where the prosecution makes this distinction and it's persuasive to the court, like all the cases that the state cites in his reply brief. But this is a people's appeal of essentially a question of fact, that you guys don't need to reach this question of whether there should be a rule about distinguishing between opinions about race and race at step two, because ultimately the state is asking for you to review the court's credibility determination and the juror's credibility. The fact that the court thought that the juror could be fair is something that the court considers at the third step, because the court is evaluating. I mean, that was the rationale that the prosecutor was putting forward that was race neutral. She cannot be fair. And the court can say, I don't believe you, prosecutor. I think this is related to her race. I think she's going to be fair. I observed her, and I observed you, and I know you, and I'm going to resit this juror. And that's what happened here. And there was, I mean, the larger problem is that the state is trying to appeal the factual finding. And the state should not be allowed to appeal the court's ultimate factual finding as discrimination, because the ultimate ruling should be sustained unless it's clearly erroneous. And nothing here, I mean, I think there's adequate record support for what the court did based on what the juror was saying during voir dire, the fact that the prosecution had struck two African-American jurors, the only African-American jurors. And so, you know, there's support for what the court did, and I'm sorry, at this point, Mr. Larkins asks this court to dismiss the people's appeal or alternatively affirm the court's ruling. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nosner. Mr. Cooper, it looks like you have about 1 minute left for rebuttal.
Yeah, I'm not going to start, Mr. Cooper, if such only a minute. If I understand you're saying from the words that the court said that we can be assured that it was a step two ruling or finding, but if we can't tell the difference, what happens to your position? If we can't tell whether it's a step two or step three ruling, what do we do then?
You should disapprove the court's ruling for a conflation of the two steps and a failure to articulate its findings, or alternatively, you should dismiss the appeal on the ground that you lack jurisdiction over it because it is a factual question and a credibility determination. But it's not. A step three credibility determination brands an attorney as a racist and a liar. A racist because it is a factual finding that the lawyer has engaged in purposeful discrimination based on race, and at step two has lied to the court by saying that actually the lawyer was motivated by something else. You can't brand someone with that based on these types of findings. This was a step two finding based on a question of law. They accepted the defense characterization of this as being a facially racist reason, and it's wrong as a matter of law. Lower courts need clarification on this. The Court of Appeals should issue a published decision clarifying that this is a facially race-neutral reason. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cooper, and again, thank you, Ms. Nosner. We appreciate your helpful arguments in this case. And this matter will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.